And away we go. So, as usual, like I always do, bones first, joints after, and then muscles. And of course, we've, you know, talked about the joints in terms of the relationship of the, sorry, the screen looks weird with that chair there. When we looked at the orientation of the sagittal joints in the spine. So some things to always remember, you know, the, where's the axis of movement here, and a muscle always has to cross the joint in order to affect it, right? So keeping those in mind. So the first is trapezius, also known as traps. And one of the things that I'll allude to in this muscle is certain parts of this muscle always get forgotten when they get when this muscle gets treated. So it's called the trapezius because it looks like it's a shape like a trapezoid. Everybody remember what a trapezoid is in math, right? Kind of that thing. We will only be addressing the upper fibers for this course, and we'll address the mid and lower fibers next course. So the mid and lower fibers tend to have more effect on the scapula and the relationship to the glenohumeral joint, whereas the upper fibers, because they do a touch-up in the head, have more of an effect on the C-spine, so hence the reason why we're addressing them here. So it's upper attachment as the external occipital protuberance, medial one-third of the superior nuchal line of the occiput, the nuchal ligament, and the spinous process of C7. So think of where that is. Looking all the way across here, right? All across and attaching all the way down. Got the nuchal ligament here and C7. So most people or therapists, when they work on trapezius, they get into this upper thickness of what represents this area here, and they never get up into this occipital region, right? If you're going to work with trapezius, you've got to get up. If you're going to affect it, you've got to get all the way up to this occipital protuberance and the superior nuchal line of the occiput, right? It's significantly up there. So, again, I always see therapists get about three-quarters of the way up, and you got to get all the way up to the top if you're really going to affect change. In fact, one of the things you can do is literally shove your thumb into that superior nuchal line and get in there, and you can affect change on the muscle as well. And it runs to the lateral one-third of the clavicle and the acromion. Now, we haven't really talked much about the acromion and the clavicle, but fundamentally, of course, your clavicle is your what you know as your collarbone, and your acromion is the flat of your shoulder. So you, when you look at a scapula, it is this flat piece up here that's the acromion. So here we're looking at, if I put it this way, you're actually looking anteriorly of the scapula. Of course, the rib cage would be here, hence the reason why you don't see it. This represents the posterior aspect of it, but the acromion comes off of this part of the scapula and is this flat area that overrides the top of the glenohumeral joint. And it's here at this point that the clavicle actually attaches to it. So you have to understand the trapezius comes from this occipital region and it comes, flares out and down and comes out towards this area. So it's, you know, this would be medial, and this, of course, is lateral. So the muscle comes down and flares out here to attach onto this acromion and then comes anteriorly over onto the clavicle into this small area here, okay? So it does have an effect to some degree in elevating the scapula, the scapulocostal joint. Now, we haven't talked about a whole lot about the scapulocostal joint, but it's not really a joint. The scapula only articulates at the glenohumeral joint and the acromioclavicular joint. The body of the scapula sits on top of the posterior rib cage, but it's held in place by muscles. So it is significantly important to understand that it does need that excessive movement in order to have the glenohumeral joint function with that. Have you guys done scapular lifts at all yet? No? Okay. Maybe if you have time later, I'll show you. So it elevates the scapulocostal joint. It also retracts the scapula at the sternocostal joint, or scapulocostal joint. So it pulls scapula back and closer together when working bilaterally. It also upwardly rotates the scapula at this scapulocostal joint. You have to have scapular rotation in order to achieve full abduction. Okay, if the scapula can't rotate, your abduction will get to about here, and that would be it. So it's something you'll want to, again, a little back pocket thing for a little bit later on planting the seed. Patient comes to you, shoulder pain, can only get so far with an abduction. The question, of course, most people will say, well, is there something wrong in the joint? But it could be that the muscles that actually hold the scapula in place are tight and the scapula can't rotate. I won't examine you on this for this semester, but for every degree of abduction is 2 degrees of rotation of the scapula. So the scapula actually has to turn because what it's in fact doing, you see, if I took this glenohumeral joint and I tried to abduct the arm, you can see how it would jam up into the acromion and can't get any further. So what happens is as the humerus is abducting, the scapula rotates, which allows for this orientation between the head of the humerus and the glenoid fossa of the scapula. It maintains it to keep in position so you get full abduction. In fact, by the time you get to this point, really the humerus isn't moving a whole lot anymore. It's the scapula rotating that finishes you off. Okay? Again, something to we'll be talking about definitely next semester when we're looking at the shoulder. It does have a reverse motor action. So in this case, we're talking, it elevates the scapula, rotates the scapula, and retracts it. But if those are fixed, in other words, they're not moving, this actually extends the head and neck of the spinal joints when working bilaterally. Now, we have to understand here, it says three things here. Head and neck at the spinal joints. Remember, muscle has to cross the joint to have an effect on it. So, of course, it's going to have movements of the cervical joints, posterior cervical joints, right? Because it's crossing every single one, C7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Because it's going all the way up to the superior nuchal line, it's therefore crossing the joint between the occipital condyles and C1, correct? Does everybody see that? So, therefore, not only does it extend the cervical spine, it also extends the head, because it crosses that C1 occipital joint, and working when both sides are working bilaterally, up goes the head. Everybody follow that? Okay. It contralaterally rotates the head and neck at the spinal joint. So where's the axis of movement and rotation? Right there, up and down this way, okay? So it's a contralateral rotator. In other words, when the right one contracts, I look left. How's that work? Yeah, if you put your finger on your external occipital protuberance and rotate left, is if you rotate left, is it moving more towards the right shoulder? Right? It is, isn't it? I put my finger here and I look right, lo and behold, yes? Okay? So because these lower parts are fixed, when it works unilaterally, it's pulling, shall we say, from the scapula to the nuchal line this way. So therefore, you're contralaterally rotating. Yes, no, maybe? Does everybody understand that? Not sure. I'm not getting much feedback here. Okay, so let's do it this way. Let's do it this way. I'm not going to spend this much time on every muscle, but I think as a sort of as an introduction, we'll be a little more complicated with this or more informative. So there's your noggin and your nose. Okay? This is your shoulder, shall we say? And we're saying that this muscle finds attachment here and here at the acromion and the clavicle, correct? So if the axis of rotation is here, well, this muscle meets the criteria because it goes from here to here. Therefore, because it's posterior to the axis and coming laterally from the side, when it shortens, it's going to pull in this direction, therefore the nose is going to go in that direction. Does that make more sense now? Okay? So that's again, when you start hearing actions of muscles, the more we get into them, you've got to start thinking of where is that axis, where is the muscle attachment in relation to that axis that causes it to do what it does. Quite often when we talk about muscles, the actions are extremely obvious. But occasionally, like this, you kind of have to think a little bit as to how is it a contralateral rotator, okay? And that's why. So bilaterally, it extends. Unilaterally, it contralaterally rotates the head and neck, okay? Because it crosses all of them, right? Where does rotation occur? Between what and what? Where does the majority of rotation occur in the C-spine? No, not the majority. It does occur at the posterior articular processes at the zygapophyseal joints, but the majority of it occurs between the dens of C2 and the anterior arch of C1. So does this muscle cross the articulation between C1 and C2? Yes, it does. So therefore, its rotation, right, at the cervical joints and also the articulation between a little bit between the head at the condyles on either side of the foramen magnum and superior part of C1, right? Okay. Like I said, I'm being picky on this one, so you can kind of follow along when you're thinking yourselves about, you know, the actions that muscles do. It also laterally flexes the head and neck at the spinal joints. So depending on which fibers work, it can either do this, or I'm sorry, I have a bad neck, it's hard for me. It does this. It brings the ear closer to the shoulder, and it is ipsilateral lateral flexion. It's a contralateral rotator, but it also has the action of ipsilateral lateral flexion. Whew. Think about it. Contralateral means opposite, so right contracts, I look left. Ipsilateral means in lateral flexion that when right contracts, right ear moves to right shoulder. Got it? Yes? Bilaterally extends the head and neck of the spinal joints and the head. And unilaterally, it's either a contralateral rotator or an ipsilateral lateral flexor. Okay? Imagine if you didn't take that terminology course there in A&P. Okay? Innervation, spinal accessory nerve, cranial nerve 11. It also has innervation from C3 and C4. C4 is bold. Why is it bold? Have I talked about this yet? Maybe I haven't. It's the major innervator. So whenever you look at a muscle that may say it's innervated by C3, 4, 5, and 6, and 6 is bold, that means the majority of the innervation arises out of C6, in this case, C4. So it's a very intriguing muscle. If I'm muscle testing it, I could be testing it for a cranial nerve issue, or C4. So if I have a disc herniation at C4 and I've really occluded or a lot of pressure on that motor neuron out of C4, then we're going to see what in this muscle? What do you think? You're doing a muscle test and you note that there's a problem with the muscle which suggests C4. What would the problem be with the muscle in muscle testing? No. You talked about this in lab. Weakness. If there's compression on the C4 nerve root, the muscle will be weak on that side. So if I had a nerve root compression on the right, I would test the left in its actions, and it would be A-okay, nice and strong, no problem. If I'm testing it on the right where the nerve compression is, it's going to be weaker. So it would be score of what on the left side? 5, and possibly a score of 4 or 3 on the right, depending on how significantly compressed the motor neuron is. Okay, does that make sense to everybody a little bit? So it's sort of your introduction to why we muscle test as well. This is why you need to know this stuff, because if the muscle's weak, I can tell you this much. When you look at cranial nerve 11, this is cranial nerve 11. Okay? So you resist elevation, okay? But if you're testing C4, you're doing the other actions, such as rotation and lateral flexion or scapular movement, okay? But you'll get into that a bit deeper, but again, I'm introducing to you sort of your first in-depth muscle here. Stretch. There's the stretch for trapezius, right? So again, how do you stretch a muscle? Contraction makes a muscle shorter, stretch makes a muscle, right? So whatever the action is when the muscle gets shorter, the stretch would be the exact opposite. So in this case, you're seeing there's your rotation, right? What kind of rotation is that patient doing there? That patient is stretching the right trapezius. What way are they rotating? What way are they looking in that picture? To the right. It's a contralateral rotator when it contracts. Therefore, stretching it would be ipsilateral rotation and contralateral lateral flexion, because it's a contralateral rotator and an ipsilateral lateral flexor. Just blew your mind. Do you understand that? In its actions, it's a contralateral rotator and an ipsilateral lateral flexor, correct? Okay. When it contracts, you either look to the other side if you're rotating, or you laterally flex to the same side if you're laterally flexing. Therefore, if you're stretching it, because remember, contraction makes everything get closer, stretching makes everything get farther away. So therefore, if it's an ipsilateral flexor, contralateral flexion will stretch it. And if it's a contralateral rotator, ipsilateral lateral rotation will stretch it. Try it. So pick one of your sides. Pick a trap on the one side, right? Laterally flex away from that shoulder and rotate looking at that shoulder. You feel the stretch now, don't you? Yes? Okay? Yes. Smelling your armpit is actually levator scapulae. The best way we learned it was stargazing. Looking up over your shoulder can help a little bit, but more so you really want that lateral flexion away and looking up, same side. Okay? But the way to remember stretches, whatever the action is of the muscle, stretching is the exact opposite. This is why you're not going to learn the stretch for every single muscle you learn, but if you know the actions, you should be able to figure the majority of them out by simply knowing it's the reverse of whatever the action is the muscle does. Okay? All right. So that strengthen as well, we can see here in strengthening, it's not so much A will work a little bit, and then in terms of it's called horizontal abduction. So the patient is doing this with the dumbbell on their side. Okay. C here will also work mid fibers of traps, but we'll get into that next semester. And of course, the one for our purposes in this course, because we're doing axial in relationship to the cervical spine, shoulder elevation is your one of the day. Yes. It'll work, yeah, A will work the middle fibers, and it'll also work infraspinatus, it'll also work posterior deltoid, okay? Here's the thing, though, the shoulder shrug, I think, is the most useless exercise there is in the gym, because who wants to walk around like this, right? These big, huge traps, you know? What were those people in Star Trek that had the big traps? Their necks went right down to their shoulders. They were one of the species in Star Trek. Anyway, I was a Trek fan, so. You know. Oh, absolutely. Come on. Okay. So the one thing I forgot, and I apologize, is Kendall. Did you get anybody bring their Kendall and their PNF book? Maybe, likely not. That's okay. We're going to start bringing them, okay, because they will be in there, but the pages are here. Now, you guys aren't doing proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation yet. We'll be talking about those when we're done the muscles. It's a form of stretching that we do that's very highly effective, and we're going to talk on the theory on that after we're done all the muscles in the latter part of this semester, okay? And then your muscle test, of course, is the setup. We don't have to worry about seeing it today. You've got your book and look at it. So I alluded to the fact that, muscle testing, I was looking at it in terms of cranial versus spinal nerve. This is where you start to use your Kendall book, and the page is right there for you. So you can go home, look at your Kendall, and see the setup for the muscle test. Remember the muscle testing rules, right? Stabilization and standardization. So patient is stable, so they're not using secondary muscles to perform the test you're after, and they're nice and stable, whether it's where your hand is or where they're sitting or whatever. So remember those things that we talked about, okay? So, upper trapezius. Why I believe this statement, that's why I wrote it. It's said to be the most common muscle for trigger points. Yeah, somebody shoves their thumb here into your upper trap. Do you have a referral pattern a lot of times? Or not? A big ball in your upper traps, most of us? Yes. Okay. All right. So it's thought to be a cause for temporal headaches, and you can see I always remembered it as the backwards question mark. That's how I always remembered it for myself. You can see here the trigger point A up in these fibers here, up in the upper fibers here, up into the temporal area, can be the angle of the mandible as well. So referred pain unilaterally along the posterior lateral process of the neck to the mastoid process, and that's the important part as well. A trigger point on the right only refers to the right because some muscles we're going to learn, the trigger point can cross the unilateral side. So a trigger point in this muscle will refer on the side that you're palpating the trigger point in, okay? When pain is intense, the side of the head centering in the temple and back of the orbit, it may include the angle of the jaw. Trigger point two is a little more posterior back here, kind of over the scapula. Its pain pattern lies slightly posterior to the cervical reference zone for trigger point one. So this is the cervical reference zone for trigger point one here, and trigger point two is a little more behind in this area here, which you can sort of see here. Okay. Okay. Splenius. Now, splenius, the term actually means bandage-like. So whomever again was doing dissections way back when thought this looked like a bandage, like a big guy, like a gauze bandage, a big thick bandage. Okay. So splenius capitis. So the fact splenius means bandage, capitis means head. So it's a muscle that goes to the head. It arises from the nuchal ligament from C3 to C6 and the spinous processes of C7 to T4. Think of where that is. So obviously, some of the things you want to do is when you're partnering up studying this material is palpating each other. When you're in lab palpating, you should have your muscle attachments open to you so you know what you're kind of doing. Are you doing that in lab a little bit? When you have time? Okay. So, nuchal ligament, where's that? Right? Filling in that space. C3 to C6. So C1 is the first one you can't palpate. C2 is the next one. So the next one below that, C3, right? Okay, spinous process of C7, or sorry, nuchal ligament from C3 to C6, and then spinous processes of C7. You can see here, okay? Here's your nuchal ligament here, right? Here's C3 coming all the way down here to the T spine. So again, C3 to C6, spinous process of C7 to C4. There's your C3 here, and then spinous processes, nuchal ligament here, and then spinous processes down below. Nuchal ligament superiorly, spinous processes inferiorly. You can see a little more here as well, splenius capitis. I don't, this one's not so bad, but this one's right out of your book, right? This was using the same picture that's in your textbook. It goes to the mastoid process of the temporal bone and the occipital bone, the lateral one-third of the superior nuchal line. I know why you needed to know all these things when I was teaching you the bones, because they're going to start coming back over and over again. So let's think about this for a minute. This muscle arises from the midline. We're talking the nuchal ligament and spinous processes down to T4 and reaches out to the lateral aspects of the superior nuchal line in the mastoid process. Everybody follow me? So I'll, you know, I kind of do this sort of thing. So here's the midline, and it reaches up and out. So the fact that it reaches up and out tells you what kind of actions can you expect. It's reaching up from behind. Right, your spine's back here. So it's reaching forward and up to the mastoid process. So what's it going to do? Flex? No, it won't flex. I could, or because it's reaching out and over to the mastoid process. Correct. Rotation. What kind of rotation? So if the right one's reaching out and pulling the mastoid process, it's a lateral rotation unilaterally. Correct. Okay? See, once you get into it, it kind of makes sense, right? That's why it helps to know your attachment. Some of you are looking at me like, are you crazy, Brian? What? Okay, so it extends the head and neck of the spinal joints when it's working bilaterally. Okay, when both the right and left are working, you're looking up. It ipsilaterally, laterally flexes the head and neck at the spinal joints when working unilaterally. Meaning if the right one contracts, the head goes right. It also ipsilaterally rotates the head and neck at the spinal joint. This is how I ask questions, right? So now we know upper trapezius does what? It is a contralateral rotator, ipsilateral lateral flexor. Whereas splenius capitis is a ipsilateral rotator and ipsilateral lateral flexor, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, dear God. Yeah. And yes, you do need to know it to this depth, because you are going to be testing patients for problems. You're going to need to know what functions they can't do. And then if they can't do something, you and your great knowledge that you will have coming out of this course will know the one or two or three muscles that only do that action that you can now investigate as being the problem as to why the patient can't do something. This is why it's so important to know it to this depth, because now you can help them. Because you go, oh yeah, Brian taught me there's pain on ipsilateral lateral flexion. Which muscle does that, right? This is why it's important. Innervation, cervical spinal nerves, the dorsal rami, middle cervical, okay? So when dorsal means what? Right. So when a nerve root passes out from the spine, all right, in that intervertebral foramen. Remember that? Remember the intervertebral foramen? So a nerve root passes out through that intervertebral foramen, and it goes off to where it's going to go to. It could be an arm farther down or whatever it may be. But as soon as it leaves the spinal column, there are dorsal and ventral roots. So a ventral root will travel anteriorly from the motor neuron to innervate in that area, and the dorsal root will head posteriorly back to innervate muscles back there. Okay? So what this is saying is this muscle is innervated by the cervical spinal nerves via the dorsal rami middle cervical. So in other words, in the middle cervical, when that motor neuron comes out, there's a dorsal branch that comes in and innervates right into these muscles, right into this muscle. Okay? It's almost all of them because it runs so far through. It's pretty much all the way through. Okay. So muscle test, again, for it is in there in the book. There is no PNF for it, and there is some strengthening. So, again, here we can see. You can see how it's an ipsilateral rotator and an ipsilateral lateral flexor. Our stretch is here. So what's the distinct difference between this and upper trapezius? This could be the armpit sniff. Upper, yes. Right. So in upper trapezius, you still have lateral flexion, but you have ipsilateral rotation. And in this one, it would be contralateral lateral flexion and contralateral rotation. Dear God, right?
Question,
when it its actions are ipsilateral rotation and ipsilateral lateral flexion. Therefore, the stretch is contralateral rotation and contralateral lateral flexion. Just whatever the action is, the stretch is the exact opposite. Okay? You guys need a break for 10, 12 minutes, somewhere there? Okay, go take a quick break. And away we go. Okay, so let's continue, shall we? So, what happened there? I must have pushed the wrong thing. All right, so you can see in this diagram, I have both stretches. I have passive and active. If you guys talked about passive and active in lab, passive is what? The therapist does it, and active is? Right. So this is passive and active. So the setup for the stretch of this muscle, on the left is active, the patient does it for themselves, and on the right is the therapist doing the stretch on the table. And that's the other thing that's going to happen in your OPs. At some point, you're going to be asked to do a stretch in a treatment with a patient on a table. Right? So you have to pay attention to that as well. Right? So we're doing spontaneous capitis here. Stretch or strengthening. A couple different ways you can do it. Again, passive and active. And I do talk about this in strengthening a little bit later on after we're done the muscles here, where the patient can do it themselves. In this case, they can use the surgical tubing or sheet or bands to do it themselves, or you, the therapist, can be the resistance. So in this case, the gentleman has his hand at the back of his patient's head, and they're pushing against the therapist's hand, and the therapist, therefore, is applying the resistance that would have the muscle contract to work against. Okay? Spontaneous capitis has one of the easiest trigger points. Trigger point in spontaneous capitis has pain right in the vertex, right on the top of your head. So you can see, you know, they got a lot of stuff here. A patient comes with a headache of some kind or other. If you know your trigger point patterns, you can probably kind of pinpoint maybe where the headache's coming from. Okay? Splenius cervicis. So this was splenius capitis, which means it attached onto the mastoid process and the superior nuchal line of the head. So when we said this muscle affects, we said, just to go back, we said head and neck, right? Because it crossed splenius capitis. Splenius cervicis is neck. So it arises from the spinous processes of T3 to T6. So how does that relate to splenius capitis? It is inferior to it, right? Remember, it went to T4, okay? Splenius cervicis goes from T3 to T6. So capitis was nuchal ligament, C-spine, a little bit of T4, down to T4. Splenius cervicis is T3 and goes down further. So it lies below capitis, right? And it goes to the transverse processes of C1 to C3 on the posterior tubercles. So in other words, it does this. Right, here's capitis here. You can see it's superior to cervicis, right? Nuchal ligament, spinous processes to T4. And then we can see here splenius cervicis. It arises from the spinous processes of 3 to 7 and the posterior tubercles of C1 to C3. Okay? So in other words, its actions, are they going to affect the head? No. Because it doesn't cross to attach to the head. So capitis affects the head, cervicis affects the neck. So if it's going from the spinous process to the posterior tubercles on the TVPs of C1 to C3, I want you to get a sense that this muscle, not unlike capitis, is going up and reaching forward. Because it's arising back here on the spinous processes, and it has to reach forward and up to get to those posterior tubercles on the transverse processes. Do you see that? Back here is the spinous process. Now over there, four anteriorly, are the TVPs. Not a whole lot, but it's still anterior, right? Your transverse process is anterior to your spinous process, yes? Okay, so this muscle is reaching up and forward to grab those posterior tubercles. Therefore, what kind of rotator is it? An ipsilateral rotator, right? Because it's the right muscle is on the spinous process, but it's grabbing the right posterior tubercles. So the fact that it's grabbing the posterior tubercles means it's to the side of rotation, right? Because the axis is down the middle, and therefore it's pulling those posterior tubercles on those TVPs closer to the spinous processes, isn't it? Do you see that? Yes, no, maybe. Okay. So, bilaterally, it extends the head of the neck at the spinal joints, not the head and the neck. Capitis extends the head and the neck bilaterally. Cervicis only extends the cervical joints when working bilaterally because it doesn't cross onto the head. Okay? It laterally flexes the neck at the spinal joints. It is an ipsilateral lateral flexor when working unilaterally, and it ipsilaterally rotates the neck, not the head, at the spinal joints because it doesn't cross onto the head. Innervation are the cervical spinal nerves, the dorsal rami, lower cervical. Okay, that little branch comes back. So we can see it here. Here's splenius capitis here. You can see it, you know, nuchal ligament and the SPs here up into the mastoid process, superior nuchal line. And then you can see down here splenius cervicis. You know, where splenius capitis goes up to the head, splenius cervicis does this little root to the transverse processes, right? And you can kind of see it here, just up to those posterior tubercles that you can see here and there as well. Remember I said you can palpate the tubercles? Right? Remember, you have palpated the spinous or the transverse processes of the C-spine in lab? Yes? Okay. So get to the posterior aspect of that and get your little pokey thumb in there. And you can't isolate this muscle, but you can certainly work, because there are other muscles that find attachment here, you can certainly work on those attachments on the posterior aspect of the transverse process of the C-spine. Okay? Stretches are kind of same as capitis. You can't really differentiate too much, other than the head wouldn't be involved as much. Of course, it would still be the cervical movement. So, trigger points in here, the upper end here. So at the very top, up near the posterior tubercles, you get diffuse pain through the inside of the head, focusing severely behind the eye on the same side. And it can occasionally go to the scalp over the occiput. But it's going to seem weird when you say to the patient, where's your pain? It's behind my eye. Huh? Initially, you might go, maybe it's a brain problem. The nerve to the eye or something, right? But no, they'll express pain behind the eye if they have a trigger point in this area. Okay? Or you'll push in it. It'll be a latent trigger point. You're doing some work in their spine, and boink, you hit it, and they go, whoa, that's right in my eye. That'll happen. It's happened to me many times. Okay? Then you know you got a trigger point. The lower end, basically down by the angle of the neck, you get pain upward into the base of the neck. Okay? Now, you do take note that the lower trapezius and this muscle can be somewhat similar. Into somewhat the same area, okay? Okay, suboccipitals. I'm assuming you've done suboccipitals in lab? Yes? Okay. Did you find them? You think? All right, so this suboccipital region is the upper back of the neck. It is triangular area located between the occipital bone of the skull and the superior end of the vertebral column between the posterior aspects of C1 and C2. So you can see here you have this triangulation kind of occurring here. It lies deep to trapezius and semispinalis capitis. Now we're going to be doing semispinalis capitis a little bit later on, but for our purposes right now, it lies deep to this area. I love this area. I worked on this area on people all the time. Some nasty stuff can happen here in terms of headaches and pain patterns and people coming in. And I used to work this area. Anytime I had to work posterior cervical spine, I always went into this area. Most of us sit with anterior head carriage, so these muscles really get affected a lot with trigger points. So we can see them here. You have this sort of configuration occurring. You can see there's a little triangular area there. We'll kind of get back to that in a bit, but understanding where they are here. So when we look at them, there's four muscles here on each side. There's a right suboccipital area, of course, and a left suboccipital area. They're mainly postural muscles, but they can help with movement of the head. So hence the reason why if we have bad posture and anterior head carriage, these really do get affected quite a lot because they work so hard. They're working a lot to kind of keep your chin from ending up on your chest, right? All right. They're all innervated by the same nerve, the dorsal ramus of C1, and this is strictly a motor neuron. So it's what causes these muscles to contract. So the nerve that comes right out from C1, there's a back branch that goes right into these muscles, innervates all. Okay? So rectus capitis posterior major. Did you use these terms in lab, or did you just talk about suboccipitals? Yes, that, hey, you didn't differentiate them at all? Okay. You did or you didn't? Okay. So rectus capitis posterior major, it's a triangular muscle, and as I said, it's mainly postural. It arises from the spinous process of C2. Spinous process of C2, right? The first spinous process when you're palpating. And it goes to the lateral part of the inferior nuchal line on the end of the occipital bone. The lateral part of the inferior nuchal line in the occipital bone. So you have the superior nuchal line, then you have the inferior nuchal line. Is the inferior nuchal line palpable? No, but you can't affect change in this muscle belly. You can't get to the attachment, but you can get to the muscle belly. It extends the head and neck at the atlanto-occipital joint when it works bilaterally. It can laterally flex the head at the atlanto-occipital joint unilaterally, and it can help to rotate the head in the ipsilateral side. All minor, right? It's sort of helping those muscles that have more major responsibility for those movements. It's mainly a postural muscle, but it does get affected in some movements, okay? Or it does help in it. Innervation, I said, dorsal ramus C1. There is no muscle test. There is no stretch. And strengthen a PNF. Now, there is a stretch, but it doesn't isolate particular muscles. It's for the whole region. Okay? Did you do that in lab? No problem if you didn't. Okay. All right. So here we are. So we're looking at rectus capitis posterior major. So from the the spinous process of C2 up into this inferior nuchal line, what do we say? And the occipital bone. Okay? So this one right here. So it's kind of in the middle. Here's your midpoint, right? Your EOP, your superior nuchal line. Here's your inferior nuchal line. This one runs right in the middle between the two other ones that find attachment in this area. Okay. The stretch is as follows, and it makes no difference. So just sit up for a moment, drop your pen for a minute. Okay. So just put your chin to your chest. Okay. Feel stretch kind of posterior cervical area. Right, if you don't, pull your head down a bit, kind of feel stretched there a little bit. Come back up. Now what I want you to do is I want you to tuck your chin in. Keeping your chin tucked in, now try to bring your chin to your chest. Yeah. Feel the difference now? You got some pain in your arm? You probably got some. Okay, so keep that. Do you feel the difference in the stretch? And some of you can't get very far, yes? And you got a lot of discomfort up here? You're cramped? Yeah, so you need some work. Okay, they get worked a lot when you're sitting, okay? So the stretch is chin in and pull the head down, okay? It means all your fascia's got a problem. Okay. Next is rectus capitis posterior minor, which must mean what? Similar but smaller, right? So it arises from the posterior tubercle of the posterior arch of C1. So it's higher. Major was spinous process of C2. Minor is posterior tubercle of the posterior arch of C1. Okay, one little bit higher. And it goes to the medial one half of the inferior nuchal line. and this one went to the lateral part of the inferior nuchal line. So in other words, minor lies medial to major. And you can see it here. So we see we got spinous process of C2 to the inferior nuchal line in the occiput, lateral aspect, and then minor arises from the tubercle on the posterior arch of C1, and it goes to the medial part of the inferior nuchal line. So minor lies medial to major. Yes. No, they're pretty much on the same level, and I'm going to show you a little way how to find them, okay, and here in a second. Right, same stretch, doesn't matter. Okay, so that was, right, rectus posterior major and rectus posterior minor, okay? Again, no stretch, or no strength and no PNF, that kind of stuff. The next one has a little different name because rectus means more straight up and down. Okay, so rectus major and minor are a little more straight up and down, whereas the other two have a lot more obliqueness to them in terms of angle. So this is called the superior oblique of the head, also known as obliquus capitis superior. Okay, it arises from the TVP of process of C1. What? What just happened? Major and minor rectus arose from spinous process or tubercle posterior arch, correct? Midline, reaching up. This one is taking a middle left turn, and it's way out here on the transverse process. So it's on the transverse process of C1. So now it's starting way out here. So the first two we learned were medial, we're kind of reaching up a little bit lateral or just straight up. This one's now way out in the TVP, and it's going to the occipital bone between the superior and inferior nuchal lines. So this muscle is going this way. It's coming from lateral to medial. The other two go sort of a little bit medial to lateral straight up. This one, obliquus, goes from the TVP and goes medially up into its attachment. Okay? It protracts the head at the lateral occipital joint, which is this primary action. Protraction means forward. Okay? It can laterally flex the head at the lateral occipital joint, extend the head at that lateral occipital joint. Now, it is a contralateral rotator of the head. Does that make sense? If it's coming from the TVP and reaching this way, when it contracts, what way is my head going to go? The other way. Right, I'm bringing the occiput closer to the TVP of C1, so the nose is going to go that way. Right? Everybody see that? So it's here. You've got it from the TVP to the occiput. So it's a bit of a contralateral rotator. So rectus capitis posterior major in the middle. Rectus capitis posterior minor above and more medial. And the most lateral of the three is obliquus capitis superior. So major in the middle, minor medial, and obliquus capitis superior lateral. Okay? Innervation, of course, dorsal ramus C1. The last one is called inferior oblique of the head, or obliquus capitis inferior. But guess what? Somebody must have been smoking something when they did these dissections, because this muscle does not attach to the head. It doesn't attach to the head. It runs from the spinous process of C2 to the transverse process of C1. So, right, spinous processes upwards with major and minor. Obliquus from TVP of C1 to the space between the inferior and superior nuchal lines, medially. And this muscle doesn't even go anywhere near the head. It goes from the spinous process of C2 to the transverse process of C1. In other words, below superior. So it comes from across here, like this. See the triangle here from the lateral view? Makes this big, big triangle right here. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Okay? It ipsilaterally rotates the atlas at the atlanto-occipital joint. That makes sense? Superior is going this way, so it's going to contralaterally rotate. And inferior is going this way, so it's going to ipsilaterally rotate. When I talk about this, I said all the suboccipital muscles are innervated by the dorsal ramus of the C1 nerve. This is what I mean. Here's the spinal cord that we see here. And then we have the dorsal root of the spinal nerve here, and we have the ganglion here of the ventral root, okay? So we've got ventral is sensory. Oh, what's that? Oh, okay. So you can see how you get these branches, these roots. One comes off of the spinal cord and one goes into the spinal cord. In, of course, being sensory, out being motor. But you'll see as it's coming out here, you get a branch straight back, right? That is your dorsal root. It's heading straight back. But you also get a branch that goes immediately anteriorly, and that's your ventral. So you have a posterior root and a ventral root here. And that's all we're saying is that, and that motor neuron comes out, it has a branch that heads back and a branch that heads forward, okay? So we're saying, of course, dorsal ramus of C1, so dorsal meaning in the back. Now, this triangle that I sort of showed you in this diagram here is kind of important because when these muscles get tight, they can cause some weird symptoms. So the suboccipital triangle is a deep triangular area between rectus capitis posterior major and the superior and inferior oblique capitis muscles. Through this triangle run nerves and blood vessels. So picture, if you will, if these muscles here that make up the triangle, rectus capitis posterior major and both the obliques, they get that triangle and make it smaller. Therefore, they can put pressure on a nerve or not fully occlude, but bother a blood supply as well. So because of that, if these muscles are tight, some of the presentation you can get is headaches, blurry vision, tinnitus, and vertigo. Everybody know what tinnitus is? Ringing in the ears. So you can get this weird stuff when you're in here. Even when you put your thumb in there, they might go, whoa, I'm feeling dizzy all of a sudden, okay? So here's your suboccipital triangle here. And as I said, nerves and blood vessels pass through this triangle. We have lots of triangles in our body that allow things to get around where they need to go. I guess conceivably, but not syncope, maybe more like vertigo type of thing, more so than passing out, going unconscious. More vertigo where the world suddenly turns upside down and they're kind of out of it. Okay? So I need a head. I won't go hard at all. Are you okay to lay on the table here for a minute? Come on. Be brave. It's only so I can show you. Just here, go on this one here. It's a bit longer. Everybody can look front and behind. Put your head here. Lay on your back. Feet down that end. Okay. So if we think about where those muscles are, right? We've got right and left. And if we go, we can see here we have the three of them, correct? We have rectus capitis major and minor, and then obliquus superior. I can put three fingers in the area where the three muscles are. So from the perspective of the midline, so if I come in here and I just feel for the spinous process of C2, that gives me the sense of my midline, right? I'm going to come just up into the space where there isn't a spinous process. Obviously, that represents one. And then I'm going to go up into the occiput like so. And the area I can palpate represents the superior nuchal line. Okay? I can't get into the inferior nuchal line. It's too deep. But I can get into the bellies of the muscles that do go into the inferior nuchal line or in between the two. So all I do is I take three fingers. I go the most lateral one, which is obliquus. Then the middle one, which is major, and then my third finger is minor. And those three fingers, just relax your head. Give me all your weight now, girl. Is it hurt?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's real sore, right? And I'm not even doing anything. It's just the weight of her head on my fingers. So my three fingers are like this, representing all three suboccipitals. Obliquus, major, minor. Okay? I'm just like this on her head. Just those three fingers, just like that, okay? And I'm a little bit hooked, so that I can get up into the occiput, right? Give me all your weight. Okay, and then I can differentiate them. So there's obliquus. That's real sore, isn't it?
That's the worst one.
Yeah, so I'm just pushing, I'm just taking my fingertips and hooking them in, and I can just get little circles, and oh my goodness, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it feels kind of good, doesn't it?
No.
And then I'm going to do major. I'm going to get into major. Oh, wow, eh?
Yeah.
And then minor, not quite so much. A little bit, yeah. So her occipitals are bad. Then if I want to get, then if I want to get into obliquus inferior, I'm going to come anteriorly. Right, find that mastoid. You got to relax your real tight. There, right. Girl. No, it's, it makes it more painful for you. I find the mastoid process. I find the angle of the mandible, and I go into that transverse process of C1. And then I can get into there. And what I used to do was, if I turn her head, and I, you guys can kind of see here, I can get, I go behind sternocleidomastoid, right? And I can find the transverse process of C1 and just get right into that inferior one. Any referral or just sore?
Just sore.
Yeah. And I can get into that one. Crazy, eh?
Okay.
Now I'm going to show you something. So everybody thinks I'm pushing hard and I'm really deep. That's so hard I'm pushing.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel that way because I'm being specific and I'm getting into structures that are a problem. So I'm not in a, you know, it sounds, she probably thought at first I was jamming my thumb right through trying to get to the other side. But I'm not. I'm just being specific and getting into the structures. So this is why it's so important, again, to know this stuff, because you can really find problems and affect change. Notice while you're in here, there's your transverse processes. There's C2 right there. There's the anterior tubercle for scalings. There's the posterior tubercle for splenius services.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy, eh? But see how specific you can get? Again, I can't specify the particular specific muscle, but I can get into the area where the attachment is in effect change. See, because that's far worse, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's your scalings. Okay? And again, that's a hard and pushing. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. She's like, yeah, never again. I'm not going up there ever again. But how does it feel now on your head moving around? Even just that. It feels looser, and we didn't even do anything. That's one thing I want you to understand is touch is powerful. It doesn't. You don't have to get in and dig and crush and break things apart. Just even just touching a structure can make a big change. Now, it's not going to make a long change because you do a lot more than that. Do you have problems? Do you get headaches and all that kind of stuff? Do you clench your teeth or grind? That's why. See, there's an association between cervical spine dysfunction and bruxism. They teach you that in dental too? Yeah, the big association between C-spine and TMJ. So a TMJ treatment, I will always do C-spine along with the TMJ because they're so related in terms of function. Okay? So boundaries of this triangle, we've got rectus, capitis, posterior major that's superior medially. Superior oblique is superior laterally, and inferior oblique is inferior laterally. The floor is represented by the posterior atlanto-occipital membrane and the posterior arch of C1, and the roof is semispinalis capitis. So we've got all these structures that can get tight, which means the triangle gets smaller, and we have the vertebral artery that runs through here and the suboccipital nerve. Hence the reason why we can get vertigo. All kinds of weird things can happen if they're tight in here. And this kind of patient is going to come and say, I've been tested for everything and they can't find anything wrong. And you stick your finger in there and they go, holy cow, that's it. They're yours for life. Especially if you can affect any kind of change and make them feel better. This, ladies and gentlemen, is why we need to go as deep as we do into all this stuff. Because this is your approach that you need to have when you're dealing with patients. This isn't just about rubbing people in an aesthetics environment to make them relax. This is about affecting change to make them better with problems that they're coming to you with. This will show you, here's the nerves here and the vertebral artery. You can see how it's all built in here. Everything's really tight. You can see how these branches of the nerves, not only you know, do they deal with the muscle, they also go out into the skull, the occipital fascia, and so forth. And this is the reason why you got tightness in here. So all this kind of stuff can end up happening. That's out of Netter. That's how good Netter's books are. Okay. Suboccipitals, if you have trigger points here, can be referred inside the skull. It is difficult to isolate these, and frankly, you don't really need to. Just getting rid of the trigger point will help anyways, right? So I never, you know, I try to work on them all kind of at the same time. Can be called endurative headaches, meaning deep into the head. The pain extends forward unilaterally to the occiput, to the eye, and the forehead with lack of definable limits. The difference between the suboccipitals is the pain is not behind the eye, it's at the eye. Okay? Now, anterior muscles. Well, let's just talk a bit about them. As in the posterior neck, there is an anterior division that has triangular regions as well. Triangular regions, as I say, are distinct anatomical areas that allow for the passage of nerves and blood vessels and lymph to travel through. There's a lot of stuff in here, muscular-wise, where these structures, you know, these things need to get away around and get to where they need to go. The body has many, many triangles or spaces where blood vessels and nerves pass through. Axillary region, antecubital region, femoral region, and so forth. Okay. The anterior cervical triangle's boundaries are the anterior border of SCM, sternocleidal mastoid, anterior midline of the neck and the mandible. It is subdivided into smaller triangles, and there are various nerves and vessels that pass through them. You don't need to know them. You just need to understand that they're there, and therefore, tight muscles equal smaller triangles, which could equal pain patterns and all sorts of things that's compressing nerves and so forth, okay? That's just why that's there. So let's do superficial and lateral. So let's do this one first. This is a muscle called platysma, and it is an attachment is in the subcutaneous fascia of the superior chest. In other words, the pectoral and deltoid fascia. So it attaches to the fascia in all this area here, and it runs to the inferior border of the mandible and the skin and subcutaneous tissues of the lower face. So when you do this, that's platysma. All right, tightens in here, that's platysma. Okay? It is the only muscle that crosses anterior to the clavicle. All the other cervical muscles travel behind the clavicle. So it looks like that. So it travels, it's very fascial, very superficial and fascial, travels anterior to the clavicle as it runs forward. Okay? It draws up the skin of the superior chest and neck, creating ridges of the skin and neck. It depresses and draws laterally the lower lip, and it can help depress the mandible of the temporal mandibular joint. Its innervation is the facial nerve, cranial nerve 7, which we talked about when we did muscles of facial expression, correct? Okay. The stretch is any stretching of anterior muscles in the neck that I'm going to give you as we go through the other ones will bring this muscle into play anytime you're stretching any anterior cervical neck, okay? Cervical muscle, sorry. This is actually a cadaver where it's been removed, so you can see it, what it sort of looks like in the real sense, okay? Oh, by the time I'm done this semester, all these pictures won't even bother anymore. I have lots of them. Yeah, well, the fat looks like chicken fat, doesn't it? We're the same that way. That's what our fat looks like. Okay, the last one let's do, because you've probably heard it over and over and over and over and over again. You've palpated it like crazy, is the SCM, the sternocleidal mastoid. It arises from the masterior process of the temporal bone and the lateral one half of the superior nuchal line. That's the one thing that everybody forgets. They always go to the mastoid process, absolutely, but it actually goes out onto the lateral aspect of that superior nuchal line. It's not just the mastoid process. It actually comes across up into that superior nuchal line. So again, if you want to affect change, you got to get it there. Have you guys done O&I yet? Origin insertion work? Okay, so some have said yes and some said no. Oh, okay. So SCM for me, who wants to come up? Who else wants to volunteer now? I want a skinny neck. People are like, I'm not coming up. No, I'm not going to make you hurt. I just want to show you something. So when you're going to do O&I work, because, again, this is another muscle, postural, that gets affected in anterior head carriage. It tends to be a problem, okay? And it does, if we think about it, you know, we've got Mastoid process here, and then we're going to find it's sternal and clavicular here, right? So I'm going to have you rotate to the left against my hand. Push it. You see it coming up there? Okay, and relax. Okay, so because it's so accessible, you can actually grab it and get a hold of it to work on it. So I use a technique where I take the flat of my index finger on the anterior border, and then I just hook my thumb around to it and just relax. I'm not going to try to hurt you, but you see you can get a good grip on it and work with it, okay? It's grippable. The carotid artery is deep, so you have to worry about it. The jugular is just underneath it, so you have to be careful. But watch, I want to show you something. There's two heads, right? There's a sternal head and a clavicular head. So let's see if you can see me bounce off one. So there's the first one, and there's the second one. Do you feel that, right? One, two. So I can get both heads. So I can, in deep is one head, and as I roll out laterally, boom, I just came off of it. You felt that? Right? So if you grab it, my fingers are almost touching each other medially, and I'll come lateral, and I'll roll off the first muscle, and then the second one. Okay? Yeah, crazy. Thanks.
Can you do that again?
Well, actually, if I'm treating it, so I'll do the hook, but then what I do is I twist it. It puts a lovely stretch on that muscle. Okay? But before I do that, I do when I work. Always with SCM, I work on that mastoid process, superior nuchal line. Sorry, I'm just not trying to be too forward here. Then I come down here on the clavicle and the sternal area. I work these two areas first to relax the muscle, then I go into the muscle. So, thank you. Mastoid process and lateral one half superior nuchal line. The sternal head goes to the anterior superior surface of the manubrium, which is that center part here of the sternum. And the clavicular head goes to the superior surface of the medial one-third of the clavicle. So we can see it here. The sternal head is the anterior or more superficial muscle, and the clavicular head lies deep to the sternal head, and you can see it here. So mastoid process, superior nuchal line, then we've got the manubrium, and we've got the clavicle. We'll just finish this muscle and go. It flexes the lower neck at the spinal joints. Flexes, right? It extends the upper neck and head at the spinal joints, flexes the lower neck and extends the upper neck because of its placement. It's an ipsilateral lateral flexor and a contralateral rotator. Ipsilateral lateral flexor and contralateral rotator. See it sticking out? Okay. Innervation. Again, cranial nerve, spinal accessory nerve, cranial nerve 11. The test for it is in Kendall. Make sure you bring your Kendalls next week, please, along with your PNF, and then we can kind of go through them. I'll bring mine, too. And there's your stretch, both actively on the left, passively on the right. And to strengthen it, it's quite simply this rotation and provide your own resistance on the turn. Trigger points, pretty obvious. On the sternal division right, which is the anterior one, you get pain to the upper sternum, and you can get a dry cough from it. That's why sometimes I'll get in here, the patient will cough. Mid-level, homolaterally, it arches across the cheek into the maxilla over the supraorbital ridge and deep within the orbit inner margin. So you can see this intense area kind of from the temple around the eye, but it's not behind the eye. It's deep within the origin, okay? You can get to the vertex of the head as well. And then the clavicular division, the deeper one, which is usually the problem one, its referral problem is to the frontal area. I call them the headlights. Okay, get the two above the eyes. So the upper part, you get deep into the ear, posterior auricular area, and sometimes to the cheek and the forehead. Okay? Adios, amigos. There will be a quiz. You'll have two quizzes next week, A&P and clinical anatomy, right? Okay. Your what? Shoot, I forgot to do it. Yes. Okay. Yeah, because I had a meeting right after and I forgot it. I saved it. I just have to go and do it. I'll go and do it right after class, though. Okay. Someone did ask me about marks missing in A&P, but I looked and I posted them all. The A&P mark came out last week, yes? It did? Okay, great. Good. Okay.